Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They're calling it No 3-Year-Old Left Behind. Some cringe at that, some don't. Universal pre-kindergarten is the new buzz in American education. Pre-K for all. States have led the way in expanding early childhood education over the last decade. But suddenly, 08 stump speeches are brimming with pre-kindergarten promises. Democratic contenders Clinton, Edwards, Obama, and Kucinich are all talking about universal pre-K, high-quality, affordable, federally supported preschool for every 4-year-old in the land, and next, maybe every 3-year-old. Not everybody's sure they want it or what it should be, but it is hot this hour on Point, tracking the pre-K wave. Joining me first today from New York is Richard Lee Colvin, former education reporter for the L.A. Times, now at Columbia University's Teachers College. Richard Lee Colvin, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
What's the argument for universal pre-K?
Well, the main argument that is being used in the campaign for it, when it really is a campaign, is that there's a larger economic return than the actual costs. This is really based on 3 studies that looked at cohorts over time and examined their life experiences and their behaviors and calculated both what the increase in productivity and tax receipts would be and also the amount of reduced government spending. Another argument is just an equity argument. A far higher percentage of higher income kids are in high quality pre-kindergarten. Fewer lower income kids are. The latest figures are that there's 80% of 3- and 4-year-olds who are in some kind of care. I'm sorry, 4- and 5-year-olds mm-hmm. who are in some kind of care outside of the home. And, of course, that varies tremendously from, you know, sitting in front of a television set at aunt's house down the street
right.
to very high-quality $20,000 centers here in New York. So I think there's an equity argument. And, there is even the argument that gets made, sometimes a little stretched, that, you know, there will be eventually a reduction in crime if kids get on the right track early. It's also said that... we will be increasingly competitive globally if kids get on the right track early. I think there's danger here of overpromising. But
both of those themes are themes that governors in very red GOP states have been trumpeting pretty loudly. They're talking about, on the payoff side here, what good preschool, pre-kindergarten education means kids more likely to graduate high school, more likely to enroll in college, more likely to hold a job, more likely to stay out of trouble with the law. That seems to be the thread of an argument there.
That's exactly right, and it's based on a quite old now study of some kids in Ypsilanti, Michigan, that have been followed now. Really, it's really quite remarkable for 40 years, and so they look at their life experiences and they say, "Gee, there's a little bit, you know, all of those are improved in the right directions." So we can, an investment is going to return more than the cost. But again, I say there's danger of overpromising because. The state of Florida passed a universal pre-kindergarten program. The voters voted for it, and then it was implemented. And they argue that all of these things are going to happen. But the program that resulted is very, very low cost, very, very low quality. It's in no way like the program that was studied and that produced those results.
In other words, they're cramming, what, as many as 30 pre-K kids into a room and maybe or maybe not for the, nice payoff. Some things we should clarify here, Richard. First of all, universal pre-K, what exactly does that mean? Does it mean all American children required to go to school at 4 or 3? Does it mean schools, you know, putting on new classrooms full of primary colors and rocking horses?
I like that description. No, everybody who talks about this emphasizes that it's absolutely voluntary. But as I said, the reality is that about 80% of 4- and 5-year-olds currently have some time outside the home.
But that's just daycare, and people are dissing that by comparison, aren't they?
Well, that is daycare and pre-K. So, but we're talking about 4- and 5-year-olds, and that means that kids are outside the home, and good high quality, don't want to lose your question, mm-hmm. but good high-quality pre-K is really not the kind of drill and kill specter that some say. Back to your question about what does this mean for schools, that is a real issue among the advocates and the experts. Should it be in the schools where we can, you know, supposedly control quality more easily? But that's difficult. This is a very well-developed market with private players, religious players, for-profits, non-profits, and schools, and Head Start. So to say that we're going to replace it all with school-based pre-K is just not the reality.
So not required for everyone, but the idea of universal pre-K is it would be available to everyone. That sounds like an expensive proposition, and yet you say, Richard, that it feels to you like we're at a tipping point here, like there is political momentum on this. Something's going to happen in this direction. Things are happening already at the state level.
Yeah, I would analogize this to the big push for kindergarten that occurred starting around World War I. At that time, kindergarten was really seen as something to help Americanize young, immigrant children before first grade. Eventually, of course, that became universal. Right now, where we're at with pre-K is that it's being talked about by some as universal. Some argue that it should be targeted at poor kids. But the expansion continues. We've got 36 legislatures just last year that increased spending on pre-K. Mm. It's gone from about $2.9 billion about in 2005 to $4.2 billion in 2007. Now, as you pointed out in your introduction, mm. we've got a number of federal presidential candidates, Biden, Clinton, Dodd, Richardson, Edwards, who are all arguing for expansion of the federal role in pre-K. And really, the only federal participation in the past or to this date has been through Head Start, which is big.
Right.
But now there's more kids in pre-K than there are in Head Start. And the other way has been through providing credits for welfare mothers for child care. So
we're talking big numbers here, big dollars potentially, a lot of kids, and a very big theme growing, at least in a big part of the country, in a big part of the campaign.
Yep.
Richard Lee Colvin, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Richard Lee Colvin is director of the Hechinger Institute on Education and the Media at Columbia. He spoke with us from New York at the Democratic presidential debate Tuesday night in Philadelphia. Senator Hillary Clinton was asked about whether students should spend more time in school.
I would start at the very beginning. We need to do more to help our families prepare their children. A family is a child's first school. The parents are a child's first teacher. This is something that I've worked on for many years. We need to really support it through nurse visitation or social work or child care. We need to do more with the pre-kindergarten program that I have proposed.
There it is, pre-kindergarten, pre-K, and not just Clinton. Here's former Senator John Edwards asked about education policy in Philadelphia.
I think we still have two public school systems in many ways in America. We have one for affluent communities and one for everybody else. I think the things that we need to do specifically, we should have universal pre-K for all four-year-olds. We ought to deal with nutritional and health care needs of younger children, younger than 4 years of age, starting at about age two.
There it is again, pre-K, and here from Congressman Dennis Kucinich answering a question about whether students should spend more time in school.
We cut the Pentagon budget 15%. $75 billion will go into a universal pre-kindergarten program, so our children ages 3, 4, and 5 will have access to full-time daycare, and more money would go into elementary and secondary education.
Pre-K, 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 all over the debate on Tuesday night among Democrats. We're talking about the push for universal pre-K education in America. Joining me now from New York is David Kerp, professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. He's author of The Sandbox Investment, The Preschool Movement, and Kids First Politics. David Kerp, thanks very much for being here.
It's good to be here.
Is it on a roll? Is it going to happen? What would it mean for the country if it did? Can we afford it?
That's a batch of questions. Do we have a couple of hours?
Yeah, we do. At least half
it
of
is
that.
On
Let's
a
go.
It is on a roll. I mean, as Richard was saying, there's been a billion and a half dollar increase in funds for pre-K in just the last 2 years. It's the biggest new social investment that I can think of. The biggest commitment on the part of taxpayers for providing something good for somebody else's children. Not money, but a service that matters.
I thought little kids were supposed to be home with mom or grandma with a storybook and a rocking chair and a carefree life, you know, in the backyard or in the jungle gym, not in school.
Yeah, Norman Rockwell is supposed to be painting scenes of America, and I devoutly wish that were the case, because mothers and fathers and grandmothers are really children's first educators. But the reality is that across the social classes, moms are going back to work before their infants are 6 months old, and they're going to be cared for by somebody. And the idea that part of the day, part of the time when they're 3 and 4 years old, they're in a pre-K program, which is actually going to get them to explore their curiosities, is a great development.
Is the payoff as big as supporters say? I'm hearing critics pushing back and saying, well, we're not so sure. You know, this is an awfully big price tag, and the benefits way down the road, and no one's certain what they might be.
Well, I do, again, agree with Richard that there's been a lot of danger of overpromising, because if you take those model programs, they are old and they cost a lot of money. This is an area in which if you spend a lot, the likelihood is that you'll get a big return. But if you don't, you won't. And Florida is the poster child for how not to do it. $2,500 a kid. Essentially, if you can breathe and stand up, you get to open a preschool. And I visited, when I was writing the book, some of those preschools. They're pretty bad places. The best of them, the teachers are working small miracles every day.
We're talking this hour about the latest Campaign 08 pledge, No 3-Year-Old, No 4-Year-Old Left Behind, and the rising call for universal pre-kindergarten. Lots of questions here. Really interesting subject for the country and for individual families. We've been joined from New York by David Kirk, professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley, author of The Sandbox Investment, The Preschool Movement, and Kids First Politics. We're joined right now as well from Princeton, New Jersey, by Jeannie Brooks-Gunn. She's a professor of child development and the co-director of the National Center for Children and Families at Teachers College at Columbia University, also a professor of pediatrics at Columbia Medical School. Jeannie Brooks-Gunn, thanks very much for being here.
Hello.
Paint a picture of what this would look like for us. It's such a big idea, I think it's hard to get our heads around. Is it new wings on schools? Is it just a different curriculum down at the daycare center in the church basement or somebody's living room? What does universal pre-K look like?
Universal pre-K looks like a lot of different things, and it is going to be implemented in different ways in different cities across the country. In general, what we're interested in is having classrooms with highly trained teachers. We're talking about folks with early childhood education experience. In many cases, for the pre-Ks that are part of the school system, these will be teachers who've had training for being kindergarten teachers. So we're going to have classrooms with folks who've had a lot of training. We also are going to have classrooms that focus on teaching children literacy and math skills, but doing it not through worksheets, not through the drill and kill, but by making creative, interesting activities for children to do. To do this kind of education takes training. If you're going to set up a classroom where kids aren't set up in little desks doing worksheets and, of course, falling off of their chairs because they're wiggling a lot.
Yep.
But this is what good early childhood education looks like today. You can see instances of it all through the country. It's a matter of putting in place the supports and the funds and the training money to have the kinds of programs that we really want. So I don't, you know, I think as the other two speakers have said, a lot of what the issues have to do with are money and funding. A good example of a universal pre-K program that was started in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and has been evaluated and has shown really terrific effects on kids across the different income groups, by the way, not just for disadvantaged kids, which is really important.
Mm-hmm.
But that program was implemented and was able to put in place very high-quality care. What this tells us is that it can be done on citywide bases. We also know that through our National Associations for Young Children, we have materials to help people in terms of technical assistance. get their programs up to speed.
Right. Jeannie, please stand by for a moment. David Kerp, help us paint this picture, fill it on out. I'm still having trouble kind of picturing this. Universal in this case means not mandatory. You don't have to go, but it would be available to anyone and everyone who wanted to go. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of teachers. That's a lot of facilities. What are we talking here? Is it added on to the schools, which already often are sort of, you know, crowded to the gills? Or, you know, is it down at the local daycare center, but a whole new tier of much more highly paid people come in to do the education? What does it physically, organizationally look like?
Well, ideally, if you were in a classroom, you saw the kind of class that Jeannie is talking about, with well-trained teachers and a curriculum where kids are playing, but the play is really purposeful.
Where is this classroom, though? Is it in a public
school?
Well,
that's what I was about to... It wouldn't... In the ideal world, you wouldn't know where you were. You could be in a for-profit center, a not-for-profit center, a church, a Head Start program, a public school. What was going on would be the same. And what you really ought to have is a blended system in which parents get to choose which of those settings they want to be in and which... Critically, parents have the kind of information that enables them to make smart choices.
Now, Hillary Clinton, here she is in May, saying, as president, I will establish universal pre-kindergarten education through a federal state partnership based on state flexibility that ensures every four-year-old child in America has access to a high-quality pre-kindergarten program. What does that mean? Does that mean the collapse of the current daycare system? We're going to have a new regime move in. All those, I don't know, they go out of business, and we get a whole new institutions set up. Or I'm still having trouble.
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I talk to people who are working in daycare centers, remember these folks are making $8.10 an hour on average,
and many of them are nowhere near what Jeannie Brooks Gunn is describing.
These people are making less than burger flippers. Their turnover ratio is higher than for any field except gas station attendants.
Yep.
And I've never talked to anybody in the field who said to me, "Gee, I don't want any more education." And so there are states like North Carolina, that have programs that train teachers in those programs to really have those child development skills and begin paying them decent wages. And that's the direction in which we have to go. The concern about money, which both Richard and Jeannie have talked about,
mm-hmm.
is that although there's more money being spent now, there's less money being spent per student. And this is why, to just underscore the point, quality is key. If you have a bad preschool program, it's not only not going to have those benefits, it's really going to do nothing for those children.
Jeannie Brooks Gunn, David Kerp's already told us about Florida, where we had real problems, where it's said to have failed. Everybody knows the public school problems around the country are anything but perfection on the public school front. Why is it thought that universal pre-K would be better quality?
It's going to be better quality, I think, because of the training programs that we have in place that can be implemented by states. Just for a simple example, we found in some of our work that the kinds of regulations that states already have on their books for child care providers, this is for kids who are 3 and 4, those states that have more training provisions written into their regulations actually have higher child care quality. So we have evidence that the states, through regulation and then through some of the national organizations in terms of providing technical assistance, we can take the four-year-old centers that already exist and increase their quality quite substantially.
Do you expect everybody would start sending their kids to this kind of center, poor Americans, middle-class Americans, affluent Americans, Jeannie?
Yes, I do. My guess is that if we were able to take a state and offer a totally universal pre-K, and I'm talking about four-year-olds here, to everybody, that you would have a take-up rate of between 80 and 85%, and that's today in 2007. Why is that? Because, as Richard said earlier, the majority of our four-year-olds in America are in some sort of child care or child education program already. In other words, the public will is there for the four-year-old. And I think that's reflected by what our candidates are saying.
The public will or the public necessity. Lots of people working and looking for somewhere to put the kids that does something for them.
Right.
We have a lot of listeners who want to join us. I want to begin turning to them in Des Moines, Iowa. John is on the line. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm an education student, and I actually see these sorts of things. I have a young daughter. She's 2.5.
Great.
And I see she's in daycare, and the daycare center she's in does do a lot of education. Starts at very, very young. I see the difference that it makes. My mother-in-law is a Head Start educator, and you can see the difference between my daughter's relatively affluent, from a relatively affluent
yep.
family, and the kids that are in the Head Start program. They come in at 4 years old, say, they don't even know how to use silverware. They look at it like it's something from Mars.
Kids in a Head Start program don't know how to use silverware?
Right. What kind of Head Start is that? Well, that's the whole thing, is that they need the Head Start program. So when you look at something like a pre-K, universal pre-K, it seems like it's so necessary out there. And it really, it drives me crazy to hear people talk about, well, what is it going to cost us? Well, what is it going to cost us? We have the children that are coming out of poor families and don't have a history of pushing education. Their children come out, and they are years behind the children that are in middle-class and upper-class families.
So you're saying, let's go for it, and we hear that. David Kirp, it seems to be, in part, the No Child Left Behind testing and the problems and gaps that are showing up there that's driving this push for earlier universal pre-K.
Well, I find that a little unnerving. You've continued to talk about no preschooler left behind, and it's a phrase that makes me shudder because it really does, in some schools, lead to that kind of drill-and-kill program
mm-hmm.
that Jeannie was criticizing before. Kids are going to learn. Kids are naturally curious, and there's a lot that they have to learn, and with the right kind of teachers to help them, they'll learn it. But they don't have to learn in that narrow, tested, know your numbers, know your letters way. What they have to learn how to do is to have the chance to think for themselves. And I've watched the light bulbs go off across classrooms. It's an amazing teaching experience, and it's an amazing learning experience.
I'm not saying at all it should be test-driven, but it seems to me from everything I'm reading that those test scores and the gaps showing up there racially or by income are part of what is driving this push for earlier education. Is it not, David?
No, that's certainly true. Some of the startling statistics, the child of a professional family at age 4 has heard 32 million more words spoken to him or her than the child from a welfare family. And that 4-year-old from a professional household has a bigger vocabulary than the welfare mom does. So there's a huge words gap, and that translates into school success and life success. And that, as John was suggesting, is why Head Start is such an important program, and early education generally is such an important program, particularly, but not exclusively for those kids, because it's not as though there's some middle-class kids do fine, poor kids are doing terribly.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of middle-class kids who are having problems in school, and they too will benefit.
Let's take a call from Middletown Springs, Vermont. Rosemary, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I am both an early childhood professional and a parent who homeschooled my daughter through 9th grade.
Yep.
So I'm on both sides of the idea. And while I don't believe that we should be making preschool programs compulsory, and I'm glad to hear other people are agreeing with that, I absolutely firmly believe that we have to have quality, because there are parents who have to work. I mean, the main thing, parents have to work. Two parents working households are the norm these days, and so the kids have to go somewhere.
Rosemary, you've got a rough line, but we've got the basic point there, and I appreciate it very much. Jeannie, that's interesting. I mean, there's a preschool worker who homeschooled her own child, but yet says, as a society, we need something with all these two-income families. But that takes us back to the daycare, the demand for daycare.
Right. And I think we need to distinguish between the different ages of kids. I am a child psychologist, mm-hmm. after all, so mm-hmm. I'm concerned about age. What's been talked about is primarily 4-year-old pre-K, but we don't want to forget, when we're talking about child care needs, the fact that parents are working very early. About 60% of all mothers go back to work in their children's first year of life. And so we need to think about what we're going to be offering, or how we're going to help families, the majority of families in America, with their 1-, 2-, and 3-year-olds, as well as the 4-year-olds. One thing I'd actually like to say...
Could I just ask on that front what you're suggesting? Does that suggest that universal pre-K for 4-year-olds would one day move on down to 3 to 2, even to 1, where there's a public system for taking care of all American tots?
In America, I think that that would take a very long time. However, go look at the European countries. They have high-quality child care available in most of the European countries for kids at least starting at age 2. Again, people can choose to use it or not, but it is available and it is high quality.
Mm. Jeannie, let me get one more call here before the break, and I'll come right back to you. Tim is calling from Aiken, South Carolina. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have just a comment. It seems to me that the crisis in education isn't dealing with, the younger. There is a crisis dealing with younger people, but I think the people who are falling through the cracks are middle school and high school students, and it would seem to me that it would be better that the focus be on, you know, providing resources for them.
So instead of going so young, what, more teachers, more teacher training, smaller class sizes when they're in middle school? Jeannie Brooks-Gunn, what about it?
We do worry about our middle school kids. I agree with that. However, as a developmental psychologist, what we find is it's easier to change kids' trajectories if you work with them early and you give them the skills they need to do well in elementary school. So if I'm forced to choose, and obviously I would prefer not to choose, I'd like to work on the school system up and down the line. At the moment, I'm going to argue that I would like to put efforts into pre-K, and maybe you should really think about it as a more integrated educational system from age 4 to age 8. People are talking about pre-K to third grade and thinking about strengthening the early elementary school experience as well as focusing on pre-K.
David Kerp, do you see this as rolled out with availability for everyone, sort of Social Security style, or targeted first at low-income neighborhoods, children, populations of kids?
I think what we've learned from Florida and from the failure of a very ambitious universal pre-K initiative in California is that you don't want to bite off more than you can chew, and that the best way to proceed is the way that, say, West Virginia, which you mentioned at the opening of the hour, has done, which is to start with those communities that are most in need. That is, communities where the schools really are failing the kids and there are few child care and pre-K opportunities, and build from that, build from those communities gradually until you have a plan that reaches all communities and makes it possible for all communities to participate.
Well, I have to say it makes me nervous to hear of huge states so focused on this like Florida and California both failing.
Well, it's much easier for politicians to claim credit for bigger than for better.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really where the focus needs to be. Jeannie talked about the Tulsa study. Oklahoma is a model state. Mm-hmm. And other states, I think, are learning from the experience of the early goers. California now has moved away from this big, ambitious program and is going to proceed issue by issue and community by community. And that's where I think we need to go.
We're talking this hour about the rising call to push all American kids into school much earlier, 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, and the new push for universal pre-kindergarten, universal pre-K. We've been joined by Jeannie Brooks-Gunn. She's at Columbia University's Teachers College, also a professor of pediatrics at Columbia University's Medical School, professor of child development. David Kerp also joins us. He's professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley, the Goldman Center School of Public Policy, author of The Sandbox Investment, The Preschool Movement and Kids First Politics. And right now we're joined from Washington by Douglas Besheroff, scholar of social welfare studies at the American Enterprise Institute, conservative outfit. He's director of the Social and Individual Responsibility Project, author of Family and Child Well-Being After Welfare Reform. Douglas Besheroff, thank you very much for being with us.
Tom, thanks for having me.
We've got all kinds of problems in our education system. We've got competitive challenges. We've got families trying to figure out what to do with the kids. Universal pre-K can sound pretty good from that angle. What do you say?
Well, I think the danger here is that we let our idealistic picture of what a pre-K program might be like to obscure the fact that, as you pointed out a number of times in this program, getting from here to there will be very complicated. Look, today 80% of the pre-K programs labeled as pre-K in this country, not the enhanced child care and so forth, mm-hmm. but the pre-K programs are in public schools. And I think the last thing we need to do is add another year to the public school education that children, middle class or poor, receive.
You know, that's easy to say, but we've got real big problems here. I mean, you would surely agree on just the fronts I mentioned. We've got scores that aren't working at all for a bunch of kids. We've got competitive issues. Governors, including in states like Oklahoma, are saying we need this. If you diss pre-K, what do you offer in its place?
Well, that's pretty easy. But first of all, remember what the conversation was earlier in this program, because I don't want it to be just me. Most four-year-olds are already someplace.
Yes, but that's a lot of daycare. That's not necessarily anything that would qualify as pre-K.
Well, wait a minute now. There's evidence that the child care programs, many of them, are as good or better than some of the Head Start programs and so forth.
But, I mean, there's no guarantee. It can be a TV in somebody's playroom.
Well, that's right. But there's no guarantee that pre-K will be any good either. You've just had the examples of Florida and so forth. I think the answer here, and remember, if this is a pre-K movement, for all the talk we had about parental choice, there will be much less parental choice. Why not take the system we have and improve it? Now, pre-K, we've talked about working mothers. Pre-K, unless it has many other additions to it, is at best going to be 9 to 12, maybe 9 to 3. For all the working mothers we're talking about, we need care between 8 and 6. So the answer here, I really, really do think, is to look at the current system and do our best to improve it. And I think there are ways of doing that. The lessons that we are learning from enhanced child care programs, from pre-K programs, from Head Start, can be applied to the entire $75 or $80 billion program that already exists.
Let me ask you, David, if I may, why do you say there would be less parental choice? This is supposed to be available, universally available, not universally mandatory.
Well, because it's the mechanics of how this would be done. Already in the states that are trying to do this, the powers that be and the interest groups sit down together and decide, well, 5% of these monies will go to child care centers, 5% will go to so-and-so, and 80 or 90% will go to the public schools. If you're in a neighborhood where the decision has been made, that the money flows to the public schools, that's going to be your choice. The only way parents are going to have a choice here for where they put their 3- and 4-year-olds is if they get a voucher, which is the current law. These new pre-K programs do not provide for vouchers. They will be a step back from the parental choice that federal law guarantees to parents of 3- and 4-year-olds today.
Jeannie Brooks-Gunn, how about it? Is this something that's going to pull families into some kind of mauve, cookie-cutter public education that they won't want but won't have a choice?
I don't really think so. I think that the system is going to remain with a variety of players, as David said earlier, and a variety of options. Clearly, people aren't talking about taking the subsidy or voucher system that exists for poor mothers and abolishing it altogether. In fact, we are not able to provide vouchers to all poor and near-poor mothers who are working. So I think that there's room for a lot of systems. Again, I really agree with David. It's being built at the moment community by community. I do agree with Doug that we have to think very carefully about the differences between a half-day program for four-year-olds and what all working mothers need, which is care throughout the day. In fact, a lot of pre-K programs and Head Start programs that are often half-day programs right now offer what they call wraparound care to provide care for children when their mothers are working. I mean, I think that's going to be the biggest issue we have to deal with, which is how to accommodate between programs that are half-day programs and the needs of working parents.
David Kerp, who would pay for this? Would it be free? Would people who are paying now continue paying? If it's got a bigger public stamp on it, does that mean less pricey?
Well, who pays for kindergarten? Who pays for first grade?
All taxpayers. Is that the
exactly.
is that the idea
and,
here?
And that's exactly. And that seems to be entirely appropriate because if we think that five-year-olds need a good experience, we surely think that four-year-olds need a good experience. But I want to say that if you listen to the three of us,
mm-hmm.
it's really a half-full, half-glass, empty
mm-hmm.
conversation.
Yes,
because
it is.
There's a lot of agreement about the fact that pre-K is not the solution. If you really believe that just providing a good half-day program to four-year-olds is going to solve all your problems, I've got a great bridge that goes from Manhattan to Brooklyn
right.
that I'd be happy to sell you.
Yep.
That you'd, and but it's also the case that those vouchers, without giving parents the kind of information that I think Doug would also want them to have, those child care programs are of really uneven quality. What we know even of the licensed child care centers is that 1 in 8 of them aren't even safe places to be. So I do think that a model which is a mixed model where you don't, as I say, you don't know where you are. You're looking at a high-quality classroom with great learning experience and lots of child care wrapped around it so that working parents can be accommodated. That's something around which I think all three of us could unite.
But, you know, I can imagine
actually,
listeners
no.
hearing that rather skeptically, and I'll come to you, Douglas. But first, just on this point, David. I mean, people do know where their kids are, and they know the failings of those systems very often. And
I don't think so.
Well, I really don't think so.
I
talk with young mothers and fathers who say, here's where my kid goes, here's what I like about it, and here's what I don't. But I know many who don't see their daycare or preschool for 3 and 4 year olds as ideal. They're very aware of the shortcomings. What's to be, why should we be confident that this universal plan creates some kind of ideal? I don't even know where I am. It's just beautiful. It's high quality. It's excellent. What's the guarantee of that?
Well, you know, if you build a straw man, it's easy to knock him down. And I think the
California
other thing
is not
which,
a straw man.
The other thing in which we agree is the danger of the kind of idealism that Doug is describing. Mm-hmm. We don't know, and this is why it's absolutely crucial to give parents the kind of information that they lack at present. If you look at what's going on in North Carolina, where parents get to know about the quality of childcare and why it matters, you find parents migrating from low quality to high quality childcare on their own. And I think that's a model that we can apply to pre-K as well.
Doug, I heard you protesting the idea that you shared something in common with David Kerp's view here.
Oh, I share many things in common
Good.
With Jeannie and David, but
Good.
Here's where I really draw the line and where I think we're in a fundamental disagreement. As Jeannie said, 80% of four-year-olds are already in some form of care.
Mm-hmm.
More than half of those children are in full-day care, which means they start before 9 a.m. and go till after 5 p.m. in the evening. What we're talking about here is the choice between starting an entirely new program that is part day and then trying to build other services around that program, or taking the facilities where children are now and trying to improve those children, those services. I think the latter, which is taking the places where children are now and trying to improve them, is a much better way to go. It's more efficient, we'll get there faster, and I think it's the only way that we can ensure some kind of progress in quality. Starting these new school-based bureaucracies is, I think, no answer for children's needs.
Mm. Jeannie, is that a point of fundamental disagreement or not?
It's hard to disagree with Doug in terms of moving the entire system to the schools. That's why I'm in favor of a mixed model with states trying and cities different ways of setting it up, and then what we're going to see is what things work better in what circumstances. So you can have Tulsa with a certain system. We can see what works and what doesn't work in that system. The other thing to realize is from a realistic standpoint, we don't have the classrooms available in all of our elementary schools, so the system isn't going to be all in elementary schools. That's just a reality mm-hmm. right now. So when people talk about, oh, my goodness, it's going to all be run through the education system, that's very unlikely to occur. That's why so many of us are talking about mixed models and really seeing what works in what situations and what doesn't work.
Well, we're talking big, though, here, big scale. A lot of listeners want to join us. Let's go to Sadie in South Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Sadie. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you today?
Very well, thanks.
I'm enjoying your conversations with
Great.
Various people concerning preschools and daycare centers. I just wanted to share with you that I'm part of the International Children's School here in South Burlington.
Okay.
And we have been here for 18 years, and our market, as far as age is concerned, is the youngest is age 3, and the oldest usually is age 6.
So you're already doing pre-K.
We are.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to let you know that we have had great success with young children as young as age 3. We have early academics, which means that children are introduced to letters and sounds of letters. We use phonics. We're a phonics-based school.
Mm-hmm.
And we have some 3-year-old children that are taking 3- and 4-letter tests weekly and doing really well.
Do all parents want that, Sadie, or do some parents say, no, no, just give my kid a butterfly net and the great outdoors, please?
No, not at all. We are known for academics, so parents choose this type of school for their child.
Could you see it rolled out across the whole country? Is that practical?
I would hope so. You know, and you know, we also offer French and Spanish. Those are our 2 second languages we provide.
Do they take tests in those at age 3 also?
Age 3. And it's the most wonderful experience for them. I can't even begin to tell you. And we also teach children composers, and during nap time, they always request Bach or Beethoven. We introduce contemporary musicians, and so
amazing. Super tots. Our future is assured, at least out of South Burlington. Sadie, thank you very much. If everybody wants that, let's hear from another in Watertown, Connecticut. Lara, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The reason why I'm calling is because actually I am a stay-at-home mother. I do work a couple days, but
yeah.
I have 2 children, and I put one of my children into the preschool program, and I put one of my I left one of my children at home. So
was it just daycare, Laura, or was it real, you know, preschool, pre-kindergarten education?
It was preschool. In fact, it was taught by teachers.
Yeah.
And it was a private school, and I spent about $1,500 to do it.
Okay, so you've done your own little test here, and what did you find?
Okay. What I found was is that my first child who went, I felt that it was very daycare-like. I actually, here it is, I've got these teachers, private education, I'm spending all this money. And the reason why I decided not to send my second child, my daughter, was because I felt it was very expensive. And my children weren't learning anything more. I think people were pushing that whole socialism aspect of things.
Socialism or socializing? You mean learning how to get along?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the thing was, is my children were getting that, I believe, as a stay-at-home mom, we got together with other mothers and kids and things. And,
do your children perform differently in school now with those different backgrounds?
Well, here's the thing. I don't see any difference in my children. They are both A students. They're 13 and 11 now. Excellent students, both of them. I enjoyed having my daughter home. I'm very thrilled with having had that experience. I can actually, you know, throw this to the table here. But I just think that this is a very expensive program. I really don't think that this should be a government-run program. I think that parents need to have the decision. There's too much government and, you know, too many other things that are being taken from the parents. I will tell you what I think is the issue.
Yep.
Is parents. I think there's a lot of parents out there who aren't parenting their children.
Yeah, well, Laura, I mean, your kids are lucky to have you, and it sounds like you're really on the case, and you've got good outcomes there. Not everybody's so lucky, but David Kerp, what about it? Laura says, come on, I don't want government to do this. Let parents do it.
Well, I think it's great if parents can stay home and participate in playgroups and have mom there to give them all the kinds of things that mothers can offer. It's a wonderful experience, mm-hmm. and it's one of the reasons why nobody is talking about pre-K for every child. It's just that, unfortunately, lots of moms don't have the options that Laura does, which is the reason that the good pre-K experience is really, as she said, comparable to what it is that a child is going to get in that best environment of the home.
What's at stake here for children for the country, in your view, David Kerp, if we don't go to universal pre-K, given what we see happening right now?
Well, I think we're moving in that direction. That Richard's comments at the top of the hour, 36 states increasing their budgets. The federal role is going to be supplementary. The states are going to take the lead. We're going to get varying programs. We're going to get varying opportunities. We're not going to get one big uniform public school-based program for all the reasons that Jeannie suggested.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, as the brain research comes out and as all the data that says it's really important for kids to have the chance to, as we used to say, work and play well together and to learn how to control their own emotions, to wait, you know, wait in line, to wait their turn to share, that's the direction we're going. Because once upon a time we thought of kids as, you know, kids as little people who needed safe places. Now I think parents are saying they really need more than that. And whether it's, you know, Laura, who's providing them an education, or the kind of enriched preschool environment that a good pre-K can offer, they're both very good opportunities. And I think we had this conversation 10 years from now. We're talking about a fait accompli. And the big question, to go back to where we began, isn't is it going to happen, but how good is it going to be? What's the quality going to be like? What are we willing to spend?
Well, there's a big conversation on the table with big ramifications now and down the road, and I'm glad we got to crack it open this hour. I want to thank all three of you for helping us do exactly that. David Kerp, author of The Sandbox Investment, University of California, Berkeley, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Jeannie Brooks-Gunn, at joining us today from Princeton. She's a professor of pediatrics and a professor of child development, both at Columbia. Jeannie, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Doug Besheroff at the American Enterprise Institute. Doug, thanks for being here.
Tom, thanks a lot.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.